Good evening. Well, it's certainly a good thing to see the presence of everyone who's here this evening. I want to thank you for your presence here tonight. You're an encouragement to each one of us who's made it out here this evening. What I want to do tonight is I'm going to look at a story from the Old Testament, and it's a story that we've probably heard before. It's one that's commonly brought up maybe in Bible classes or even in lessons, but I want to apply it to the subject of mentorship. And that's the story of King Joash of Judah. Joash, of course, was the boy king of Judah. He was coronated when he was only 7 years old. And we often tell that story, how he was saved as a baby and then later became king at a very, very young age. But there's a different side to the story, and it's one of the more dramatic stories, I think, in the Old Testament. There's betrayal, there's murder, there's intrigue. It's a very dramatic, very complicated and twisted story with a lot of twists and turns and interesting characters along the way. So I've called this lesson The Tragedy of Joash because of the dramatic nature of his kingship. So I think what's beneficial as a background to this story is a little bit about Joash's family history. A lot of the kings sometimes get muddled in our minds. They all seem to run together. So let's just go through a quick family tree that leads up to Joash. So we start with Joash's grandfather, great-grandfather, Jehoshaphat. So Jehoshaphat was a faithful king of Judah. He was really the last faithful king of Judah before Joash came around. And yet he made mistakes during his kingship. He made alliances primarily with the northern kingdom. And that was one of the biggest things that God criticized him for. He allied himself with the wicked leaders of that king. So Jehoshaphat died, and his son Jehoram became king. And Jehoram was a lot worse than Jehoshaphat. There was really nothing redeemable about Jehoram. He was married to Athaliah, who becomes a big character in this story. Athaliah was one of the daughters of King Ahab. She was from the northern kingdom, and she was a very wicked, very evil influence on Jehoram. So Jehoram, during his reign, he ends up being struck by God. God strikes him with disease because he puts his brothers to death. In an effort to preserve the throne, he kills all of his brothers. And so the Lord strikes him with disease and he dies a horrible, painful death. So then we come to his son, Ahaziah. And Ahaziah is the son of Jehoram. And he is also evil because he rules under the counsel of Athaliah, the queen. She's still living and she has a very strong impact on his rule. And so he's wicked during his time in the throne. However, that doesn't last very long because he is then killed while he's king by Jehu. If you remember, Jehu is the one who goes through the house of Ahab and he basically cleanses the kingdom of Israel from the house of Ahab. After the fall of Ahab, Jehu's the one who goes and kills all of Ahab's descendants, and Ahaziah is included in that list. So he kills Ahaziah. And then there's a problem because Athaliah decides that she's had enough with the house of Judah. She takes over reign of Judah in Ahaziah's place. So the queen mother is now ruling the kingdom. And she immediately begins killing all the royal family. We're starting to see a trend here among the leaders of Judah and the royalty of the time. This was not very uncommon. So she kills all of the members of Ahaziah's household, save for one, and that is Joash. And as we know from the story, Joash is saved by one of Ahaziah's sisters and a nurse of his. So he's taken away as an infant, and he's hidden away under the care of the high priest, Jehoiada. So eventually, he's 7 years old, and Jehoiada takes Joash and makes him king. At that time, then Athaliah is put to death. Jehoiada puts the crown on young Joash and says, "This is the son of the king. This is the king of Judah," and the people rally around Joash. So this is where we're going to begin our story and looking at it this evening. So Joash has just been crowned king. So beginning in 2 Chronicles, turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 23. This is where we're going to pick up the story of Joash's kingship. In verse 16 of chapter 23, it says, "Jehoiada made a covenant between himself and all the people and the king, that they should be the Lord's people. Then all the people went to the house of Baal and tore it down, its altars and its images. They broke into pieces. They killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. And Jehoiada posted watchmen for the house of the Lord under the direction of the Levitical priests. whom David had organized to be in charge of the house of the Lord, to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, as it is written in the law of Moses, with rejoicing and singing according to the order of David. And I'll just summarize the rest of chapter 23 here. All of the worship has been reinstated. The sacrifices are reinstated. This is all under the guidance of the high priest, Jehoiada. Then beginning in chapter 24, we see Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zebiah of Beersheba, and Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Jehoiada got for him 2 wives, and he had sons and daughters. After this, Joash decided to restore the house of the Lord, and he gathered the priests and the Levites and said to them, "Go into the cities of Judah and gather from Israel money to repair the house of God from year to year, and see to it that you act quickly." We won't read the rest of this chapter, but just summarizing from this point until verse 14, what we see unfolding before us is there is a lot of progressive change in the time of Joash, and a lot of reform coming back to the proper worship of God. He sees to the restoration of the temple. He commands that it be restored. Later on in the chapter, he commands that a tax be levied to tax the people so that there's enough money to restore the temple. Eventually, he even puts out a collection box, essentially. He puts out a chest for people to bring their gifts and to put them in the box for the restoration of the temple. And then the box is emptied every day. And it says later on in the chapter that thus they did day by day, and they collected money in abundance, so the people are enthusiastic, they're part of the work, they're being involved. So this is what we see in the beginning of Joash's reign. It's off to a great start. The people are contributing, the craftsmen are working, money is flowing toward the house of God. Things are looking pretty good for the kingdom of Judah. And the other thing we see in this beginning part of the story is the clear leadership and the role that Jehoiada plays in all of this. Obviously, in killing Queen Athaliah and in taking back the throne of Judah for the line of David, Joash as a 7-year-old had very little to do with that. That was primarily the work of Jehoiada, kind of working behind the scenes to make sure that Joash became king. But then as he then becomes king and is an adult and is seeing to the restoration of the temple, Jehoiada is still having a role in this. As the high priest, he's still taking on a role of a mentor toward Joash and guiding him to do these things. And that's the first thing we want to look at. The first lesson from this story we want to look at this evening is the benefit of good mentoring. So there is indeed a huge benefit to having good counsel. Turn, if you would, to Deuteronomy chapter 11. God created humans in a way that we share experience from one generation to another. We're able to pass on knowledge more so than any other created thing. And God knows this, and so that's why when he has instructed his people in times past, passing on knowledge and passing on instruction from one to another is a crucial part of that. In Deuteronomy chapter 11, God is talking about the need to keep the statutes and the commandments. He says, You shall therefore love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his rules, and his commandments always. And consider today, since I am not speaking to your children who have not known or seen it, consider the discipline of the Lord your God, his greatness, his mighty hand, and his outstretched arm. So here, in speaking to the people of Israel, God makes the comment that the children of that generation hadn't seen the works that God had done. They weren't present while God was bringing them out of Egypt or while he was doing some of the wonders that he did in bringing them to the land. So he tells the parents to have a charge and to consider these things for the sake of those children. In verse 5 of Deuteronomy 11, he says, "And what he did to you in the wilderness until you came to this place," that's not where I want it to be, in verse 7, "for your eyes have seen all the great work that the Lord did." But the point of here is that it was the older generation that had seen these things. It had not been the younger generation. So he continues on, and then in verse 18 of Deuteronomy 11, he begins by saying, "You shall therefore lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, talking of them when you are sitting in your house, and when you are walking by the way, and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, that your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give to them, as long as the heavens are above the earth. The younger generation needs the instruction of the older generation. That's the way that God has designed His truth and His word to be passed on. It's what He told the people in the Old Covenant. It's the same as true today. The simple fact is that younger people don't have the experiences of those who are older among us. You have a very valuable well of information that the younger generations can draw upon, but it needs to be shared. They can't get it unless it's being passed on, unless it's being taught. So that was what was instructed to the Israelites, to teach their children. Obviously, we know from their history that many times generations failed to do that, and it resulted in oftentimes the decline of an entire nation. An entire generation would arise that didn't benefit from this well of knowledge that the older generation had. So it's crucial to the survival of one's faith and of the faith of a nation that this information be shared. In Psalm 78, the entire psalm is dealing with the sharing and the proclaiming of this information. It's telling the coming generation is the title of the psalm in my Bible. And for the entire psalm, in verse 4, it says, "We will not hide them," speaking of the things that God has done, "we will not hide them from their children, but tell them to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and His might and the wonders He has done." And he continues for the rest of this psalm, Psalm 78, to recount all of the history of Israel and all of the deeds that God has done for them and the things that they need to remember. And the things that they need to tell the younger generation, because they don't have the benefit of having experienced some of those things firsthand. But they can know about them if mentors do their work and fulfill the role of mentor. Then in Proverbs chapter 6, beginning in verse 22, or only in verse 22, it says, "When you walk, they will lead you. When you lie down, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk with you." And this is talking about a father's commandment. He says in verse 20, not to forsake a father's commandment or to forsake a mother's teaching. So this is necessary for younger generations. This is a crucial requirement and a commandment from God to instruct those who come after us, those who are younger. And the command is the same not just for the Israelites or for the generations of those times, but it's the same for Christians today as well. Look at Titus chapter 2. In Titus chapter 2, it's talking about, he's mentioned some of the requirements, some of the criteria for selecting elders. And elders are, of course, people who, a very big part of what they do is sharing knowledge and sharing teaching with a younger generation. But in Titus 2, verses 1 through 10, he starts out by saying, "But as for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Older women, likewise, are to be reverent and wise in their behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good, and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, and submissive to their husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. Likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. Show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. Bondservants are to be submissive to their own masters in everything. They are to be well-pleasing, not argumentative." So here we see in Titus chapter 2 instructions to older men and older women to teach younger men and younger women. It seems like a pretty common principle, but it's something that we need to remember as Christians. And this doesn't just apply to our children, and Deuteronomy is talking about training your children specifically, but here it's talking about all younger men and younger women in the church, learning from all of the experience that exists before them, that comes before them. Otherwise, it's a waste of that lifetime of experience to not pass that on. In verse 15 of Titus chapter 2, he says, "Declare these things, exhort and rebuke with all authority. Let no one disregard you." So clearly there is a need for this instruction, and it's very important. Also notice what he says in this chapter. He talks about older women and older men, but he doesn't say what that really is. Think about it. Do you put a number of how old you have to be one of those older Christians who needs to teach the younger generation? He doesn't say those Christians who are of age 60 and older, that's when you need to start training the younger Christians. He doesn't say that at all. So an older Christian, someone can be someone who's not much older than they are, but still has that experience. Older in experience, older in a lifetime of achievement. You could have 40-year-old Christians training 20-year-old Christians, or 20-year-old Christians training 18-year-old Christians. Really what we see here is that when there is experience and when there is knowledge, it's important that be shared. So this is the first lesson we want to gather from this story, the example of Jehoiada. Think about what he did for Joash. He was there training him, overseeing him from age 7 to supposedly the time when he was an adult. And the influence that he had in almost single-handedly redirecting the course of the nation. By redirecting the king, the people then followed. He had an amazing impact because he showed that mentorship role. Well, I told you this was the tragedy of Joash, so we need to continue in our story. So if we go back to 2 Corinthians or 2 Chronicles, we'll see how this story ends. In 2 Chronicles chapter 24, we see in verse 15, but Jehoiada grew old and full of days and died. He was 130 years old at his death, and they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done good in Israel toward God and his house. Just a quick note before we move on. That act of burying Jehoiada with the burial ground of the kings was something that was very unique for the high priest. That wasn't a typical thing that was done for high priests. So the people of Judah showed immense respect and reverence for Jehoiada. He was given this honor after his death because of all that he had done for Israel. So he's buried with the kings. Then in verse 17, now after the death of Jehoiada, the princes of Judah came and paid homage to the king. Then the king listened to them, and they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and served the Ashtoreth and the idols. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this guilt of theirs. Yet he sent prophets among them to bring them back to the Lord. These testified against them, but they would not pay attention. So almost immediately we see a 180 turn on the part of Joash. He takes counsel from the princes of Judah, apparently peers of his or members of the royal family. Not sure who exactly these princes are, but obviously they've got different plans than Jehoiada or God, and they bring Joash away from serving God. It continues in verse 20. Then the Spirit of God clothed Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest. He stood above the people and said to them, thus says God, why do you break the commandments of the Lord so that you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you. But they conspired against him, and by the command of the king, they stoned him with stones in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness that Jehoiada, Zechariah's father, had showed him, but killed his son. And when he was dying, he said, may the Lord see and avenge. So I told you this was a story filled with drama. Here we have Joash putting to death the son of Jehoiada. Now, when Joash was a baby, the woman who took him, one of the king's sisters, she was Jehoiada's wife. So presumably, Joash grew up in the household of Jehoiada. He was raised by Jehoiada. And from age 7, Jehoiada was there beside him the whole time he was king. And then upon hearing this prophecy from Jehoiada's son, Zechariah, who possibly grew up alongside Joash, Joash completely forgets all that Jehoiada had done. He forsakes all of the lessons that he had taught him, and he kills the son of his mentor. This is something that you'd expect from a movie or a serial drama, but this is the extent to which Joash turned away from God and the extent to which he became wicked. So, continuing on then in our story, verse 23 of chapter 24. At the end of the year, the army of the Syrians came up against Joash. They came to Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the princes of the people from among the people and set all their spoil to the king, sent all their spoil to the king of Damascus. Though the army of the Syrians had come with few men, the Lord delivered into their hand a very great army, because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. Thus they executed judgment on Joash. When they had departed from him, leaving him severely wounded, his servants conspired against him because of the blood of the son of Jehoiada, the priest, and killed him on his bed. So he died, and they buried him in the city of David, and they did not bury him in the tombs of the kings. So here we have the end of Joash, the end of his reign of Judah. It's a complete turnaround. We see Joash going from being so promising, building up the temple, reinstating worship, to all of a sudden ignoring the commands of God, putting to death his mentor's son, and then ultimately falling in battle because the Lord determined that he would be judged, that Judah would be judged on account of his evil. So my question this evening, what happened to Joash? What happened to this king who suddenly turned around, seemingly became a completely different person? And the thing that I would argue to you this evening is that Joash was never truly serving God. Joash never truly had faith in God in his heart. Instead, he was only following the guidance of Jehoiada, and it seems that he never internalized that advice and never made it part of who he was as a king. The truth of the matter is that sometimes, despite all good efforts, counsel doesn't always lead to somebody making the right decision. Sometimes people, against all attempts at good instruction, still want to do what they want to do. And it sounds like Joash never really took to heart the things that were being taught to him. It seems that he never truly trusted God. Turn to 1 Timothy. In the letters to Timothy, both 1 and 2 Timothy, there's a lot of valuable instruction when it comes to how to deal with teaching others and how to deal with being a teacher, because Timothy was trying to fulfill that role. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons." So here Timothy's being warned that people are going to depart from the faith. Despite whatever teaching you might try to give, sometimes people are going to ignore that. They're going to turn and do what they want to do. Then in the next letter we have to Timothy that's recorded, turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, Paul writes a similar warning, verses 1 beginning. "But understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty, for people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous and without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. Avoid such people, for among them are those who creep into households and capture weak women, burdened with sins and led astray by various passions, always learning and never able to arrive at a knowledge of the truth." So here we see, again, this warning that people are going to turn away from the truth, even sometimes despite the best of intentions and the best of counsel. The lesson here is that it is important to take possession of one's faith. We cannot have our faith be the faith of somebody else, because that is not a faith that will last. Think about whoever may have brought you to become a Christian. Maybe someone in your life influenced you to make that decision. If you rest on their faith alone for the entirety of your journey as a Christian, then that faith will not save you. The faith of your parents or of teachers who may have brought you to Christ, or elders or preachers, they're not going to save anyone just by only listening to what they have to say and only following what they tell you to do or what they say you ought to do, because it's not taking that faith to heart. Remember what Paul said to Timothy. In 2 Timothy, he says that they are those who are always learning but never able to arrive at a knowledge of the truth. So that's exactly what that always learning looks like. If I was here every Sunday and listening to every sermon and hearing every word that's being taught, but I only let it go as far as that, just hearing lessons and thinking about them, but never turning it into my own faith, making that apply to me, then I'm not learning anything. I'm not really having faith and I'm not progressing as a Christian. Instead, I'm resting on the faith of somebody else. So we need to be careful to understand this, that no mentor can have... Before I move on to that point, one thing that I do want to reiterate is that I don't want to downplay the effect that a guiding influence can have. I certainly don't want anyone to think that it's a bad thing to be brought to Christianity by somebody else. Perhaps it's a parent, or perhaps it's a spouse or a teacher, somebody who introduces you to Christianity, who introduces you to Christ. That is a wonderful thing and an important thing. In fact, I would say the majority of people probably come to Christ due to the mentoring and the teaching of somebody else. I believe that the Bible has the capability. If somebody were to pick up the Bible and simply read from it, I believe in the power of the Bible to convert that person by their own decision-making, by their own understanding of those words. But I think in most cases, we can agree that somebody usually brings you to Christianity or introduces you to the concept of being a Christian. So I don't want to downplay the importance of that. But ultimately, that's not going to last forever. Your parents or your teachers, whoever brings you to Christ, they're not always going to be there in your life. They're not going to be a continuous influence. And at some point, every single person is going to eventually have to make their own decisions about who they are and what they do. So think about Joash. That's exactly what happened in our story. Jehoiada was that guiding influence, and he was a very good influence for Joash. Good enough that it convinced Joash to do what he needed to do, to lead the people of Judah in the right way. But as soon as Jehoiada was gone, Joash didn't have, he hadn't accumulated the tools to make those decisions on his own. He had ignored letting that become part of who he was. It was merely because that's what Jehoiada wanted. And that was a failure on Joash's part, not on Jehoiada's part. It was a failure on Joash's part. So how can we avoid this? How can we avoid the problem of abandoning the faith when we lose our mentors or when we stray away from what our mentors teach us? And this is something that we need to consider because Christianity has a problem with this. There's often an issue with people leaving the faith when they leave the influence of their parents or the influence of their teachers. I did some years ago, I think it was 2006, Ken Ham, you may remember him, he's the author of Answers in Genesis. And I wouldn't recommend every single thing that he's written before, but he published a book called Already Gone. And in this book, it was essentially looking at statistics of young people leaving the church when they enter their 20s. And I just wanted to give you some figures from that book. 61% of young adults, this again was taken in 2006, 61% of young adults who they polled and surveyed who used to be regular church attendees are now spiritually disengaged, meaning that they self-reported that they no longer go to church, they don't pray, they don't read their Bibles. 61% of young people in their 20s said that they left their Christian faith. And again, their definition of Christian is the generally understood definition by society today. 20% who used to be Christians or spiritually active maintain some level of commitment. And then 19% never were Christians and still are not Christians. So that's only 20% of people in their 20s. One out of five stays a Christian according to their own definition. And this was in 2006. I can imagine that numbers are pretty similar today. We look at trends of young people perhaps leaving their parents, leaving their homes, and we think, oh, they go to college and they leave their faith. They lose their faith when they go to college. But the conclusion that's made in this book, and one of the conclusions that they say, is that it actually happens much sooner than that. Another statistic that they give is that 40% of the people who said that they left Christianity actually started doubting Christianity when they were in middle school, while they were still going to church and still living with their parents, is when they began to not believe Christianity anymore. So what does this mean for us? What do we need to do about this? Because the reality is that these cases start much earlier than expected. That's why I was saying that Joash likely never had the faith that we think that he had, because even during the time that Jehoiada was guiding him, it seems that he didn't share those beliefs himself. So what we need to do is we need to have quality of instruction. This is the first thing we need to do to combat this idea of leaving the faith or not making one's faith their own. It's important when teaching children, younger Christians, about spiritual things to not just give them the answers and then walk away. That's not going to have a lasting impact. We need to instruct people how to think about spiritual things. Give them the tools to search these things out. Think about the Bereans in the book of Acts, who were more noble because they were searching the scriptures to understand the things that they were being taught. They didn't just accept everything on face value and rest upon that. That's what happens when people don't have a lasting faith into their 20s. Instead, they gathered and built the tools up through practice and through study to understand these things better. So encourage children to arrive at their own conclusions. Find ways to study so that they can reach the conclusions themselves. Obviously, give them, you know, some necessary passages or give them some things to think about that are going to guide them toward those conclusions. But any reasonable person can make conclusions about their faith if they're given the right tools. So encourage learning that makes people arrive at their own conclusions about the truth so that they have a better understanding of it. Another tool that you can use is write a sermon. Write a Bible lesson about a topic that maybe you're questioning. You know, maybe you wonder, why do I believe a certain thing, or why do we teach a certain thing? Write a Bible lesson or a sermon about it, even if you never have any intention of presenting it, because I can tell you that the best way to really dig into what the Scripture has to say on a topic is to try to prepare to teach it to somebody else. Turn to Philippians chapter 2. In Philippians chapter 2, Paul is talking about instruction, the instruction that's necessary to have people stay in the faith and have their own faith. Philippians 2, beginning in verse 12. Paul says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has been known throughout all the whole imperial guard until the rest of my imprisonment for Christ. I'm in Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 2, verse 12 says, therefore, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent children of God, without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the words of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. So here Paul lays out, I think, three key points in avoiding this problem of departing from the faith because you never made it your own. He's telling them how to make faith their own, how to internalize the things that they've been taught. The first thing he tells them is to work out your own salvation. He tells the Christians that it is an individual responsibility to understand the things that you're being taught and to know how they work in your life, how they apply in your life. You can't pin this job on somebody else and throw your hands up when you no longer believe the things that you were taught and saying, well, I had bad teachers. It's the responsibility of each and every one of us to study and to understand these things and to see if we believe them for ourselves. The next thing he tells them, he says, do all this without grumbling or disputing. He's telling them to have the right attitude, to have the right approach to teachings. You know, young people, I can confess for our generation, we're notorious for not wanting to hear people tell us how to do things or not wanting to hear instruction from people all the time. We like to think that we know what we're doing and we just want to do things our own way. But we can't rely on that. We need to have the right attitude and look for ways to improve our listening skills and our skills of understanding. Look for ways to build on this. I talked about, you know, writing a sermon or writing a Bible class on a subject. That can be something that we can do to try to improve our approach toward making our salvation, working it out on our own. Also, not relying on just listening, but participating, asking questions, and giving answers in a Bible class rather than just listening to everyone else give answers. These are things we can do to have a more active part in internalizing our faith. And the last one he talks about in verse 16 is holding fast to the word of life. And this is the key to everything, because making sure that the gospel and making sure that the Bible is within us and is important to us, that's the thing that's going to stick with us, because The Bible has lasted for thousands of years longer than any parent, any teacher, any preacher. It is the constant that we can always turn to that is always correct in answering our questions and in building up our faith. I mentioned in the letters to Timothy, you know, he talks about how to deal with people when you're trying to teach them. It's also in the letters to Timothy where he says that all Scripture is profitable for instruction, for improvement, for reproof. It is the tools that we need in order to grow and to benefit from these things. So this is the idea, and this is the lesson that I want us to gain from this. We need to take ownership of our faith. We need to ask ourselves, whose faith do you have? Are you here because your parents always brought you to church, so going to church is always something that you have to do? Are you here because your spouse was a Christian and you go to church just because they go to church? Maybe initially that's a good reason, but at some point we need to grow and understand that our faith can be ours. It needs to be our faith that we cling to, because at the end of the day, at the end of our lives, that's all we're going to have to be judged on is our faith and how well we applied it. We can't say that, well, I always went to church because that's what Mom and Dad did. That doesn't hold up. That's not what we're being judged on. The last passage I want to leave you with, turn to John chapter 17. I've been talking this whole time about mentorship and instruction and mentors. And there was no mentor better in Scripture than Jesus. He had 12 apostles who he spent all of his ministry, his years teaching. He spent all of that time with these men, preparing them to be the people who would then spread out his words upon his death. Jesus was going to go away, and he needed people who were going to be able to continue that mission. And in John chapter 17, Jesus is preparing to be arrested. He's about to be killed. This is the end of his ministry. And he spent all of this time with his apostles, and now he's praying to God on their behalf. In John chapter 17, look at verse 7 through 8. He says, "Now I know that everything you have given me is from you, for I have given them the words that you gave me, and they have received them and have come to know in truth that I came from you, and they have believed that you sent me." Then look at verse 11. He says, "I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you. Holy Father, keep them in your name, which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we are one. While I was with them, I kept them in your name, which you had given me. I have guarded them, and not one of them has been lost except the son of destruction, that the scripture might be fulfilled. But now I'm coming to you, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world." Here, Jesus, let's continue to verse 17. He says, "I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth." In this prayer, Jesus is asking God to watch over his disciples. But he says in this prayer that he has given them the tools. He has given them the instruction. He's given them his words. And he says that they know the truth, that I came from you, and they believe that you sent me. So Jesus knows that the apostles have been told the things that they need to know. They have been told everything that they need. They're equipped and they're ready. Now, it's not going to seem like they're ready in the coming moments. There's still going to be failure on their part. But as a mentor, Jesus has prepared them to make that faith their own. And then look at the lives that each of these apostles led moving on from there. Think about the ministries that they then spread out, the mission that they fulfilled. They made that faith their own. And they understood, and they knew for reasons that they understood why they believed the things they did, because they saw it happen. And they became mentors to others who maybe didn't see it happen, but they were that influence. They were that guiding influence in those other people's lives. So Jesus is our example of both what it means to be a good mentor, and then the apostles show what it means to take that and then to run with it, to make that our own faith. Whose faith do you have? Ultimately, it becomes your own upon study, having the right attitude, and ultimately resting on the Word of God. And that's the lesson I want to leave you with tonight. So, if there's anyone here tonight who has not become a Christian, has not begun their walk as a child of God, you have an opportunity to do so this evening. Maybe you've lived your life doing things because other people have guided you to do it and have been a positive influence in your life. But at some point, it's important to take that and to make your own decisions with it. So if you need to become a Christian, if you understand what you need to do to be saved, to confess Jesus as Lord and to be baptized for the remission of your sins, we can assist you with that this evening. Or if you're a Christian and you need the prayers or the assistance of the congregation in some other way, we'd love to assist you while we stand and while we sing.